This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Now, Dr. Lyle, I'd like to call you a revolutionary psychologist, but can you just explain a little bit to us about what evolutionary psychology is all about?
Yes, evolutionary psychology was a phenomenal breakthrough in human self-understanding that took place, really, obviously it took place in little pieces over time, but the big revolution took place in the early 1990s. And it was formally introduced to the world by John Tooby and Lita Cosmides and Jerome Barco, who were scholars. The Tooby and Cosmides are at UC Santa Barbara. And I'm not sure where Jerome Barco is. He might be there as well. Anyway, in a work called The Adapted Mind. And just to sort of briefly explain why evolutionary psychology is a total revolution in the way that people are able to now understand themselves is the following, that throughout the 20th century, the dominant view in psychology, in academic psychology, there's actually sort of two big dominant forces in psychology in the last 100 years. One of them is the psychoanalysis of Sigmund Freud, and which was, you know, has certainly been considered and then largely rejected by academic psychology just because there's so many problems with it. The major dominant force in academic psychology is what's called learning theory. And learning theory is effectively, and this is something of a caricature, but it has a deep accuracy in it, is that the concept is that human beings effectively learn to be who it is that they are. So they learning theory is very much about the idea that you are shaped by your life experiences, by your what they would call your reinforcement history, into being who and what you are. The evolutionary psychology essentially completely rejects these other views of psychology and says that these folks have completely missed the boat, that that you do not learn to be a human and you do not learn to flirt and you do not learn what it is that you find attractive. I can remember listening in a seminar to a learning theorist, a very highly regarded, one of the most highly regarded learning theory academic sex therapists in the world. And she was explaining how that people learn what is sexually attractive and how much learning had to take place for this to happen. And at the time, I had already been introduced to evolutionary psychology. So this was in the early 90s. And as I'm listening to this, I'm realizing this is an example of the old way of thinking and just how utterly mistaken it is. And this woman, even though she was very bright, very capable human being, was literally way off course and had no clue what she was talking about. The truth of the matter is that what people find sexually attractive is innate. It is built into the genetic code, into motivational systems that are designed by nature to optimize survival and reproductive success. So it is not the case that we learn what is attractive. We actually are born with the ability to run phenomenal computations on ratios of people's bodies and their facial configurations, and to analyze who is more attractive than whom, and be more motivated to try to mate with those people that are more more objectively attractive. This is now, it has been extremely well established by subsequent research, but this was obvious to evolutionary psychologists, you know, in early 1990s. And so evolutionary psychology is the notion that the human mind has been adapted to the problems of survival and reproduction that took place across the natural history, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, over about a 2 million year period. And so that's why the human likes the things that it likes. It likes water. It likes the sound of water. It likes to look at water. It likes to look at trees with a lot of green. It likes to look at flowers. It likes to have views that it can see down over a landscape, looking down on predators and competitors. The human being is loaded with characteristics that come already in the system. And this is a completely different view than the view that dominated psychology until about 1990. So evolutionary psychology was the first true, it was really the brainchild of Charles Darwin, who was very clearly an evolutionary psychologist, but wasn't doing any science behind it and couldn't at that time. His ideas became out of fashion and buried, and were eventually buried in academia by both Freud and the learning theorist B.F. Skinner and others. And so as a result, it would take more than 100 years. It would take until about 1990 for Darwin's ideas to resurface. And when they did, they came along with a sophistication that is now unparalleled in the social sciences. And we now have a framework and an edifice from which to theorize about human nature that is just simply far superior to anything that we've seen before. Evolutionary psychology is correct. A young academic psychologist, I think he's at the University of Pennsylvania, I can't remember his name, he actually had a beautiful quote to describe the confusion of the critics of evolutionary psychology. It went something like this. He said, the critics of evolutionary psychology are not like marksmen who can't quite hit the center of the target. Their confusion is deep and profound. They are actually aiming the gun backwards. And this is correct. They are seeing human nature from exactly the opposite, from the correct position. The correct position is to understand that the mind is very, very carefully adapted to have thoughts, feelings, and behavior that are necessary to optimize its survival and reproduction, just as every other organ in the body has been shaped very, very carefully to have an architecture that optimizes human survival and reproduction. So your kidneys, liver, spleen, you know, stomach, lungs, everything about you has highly differentiated tissue. It was designed to beautifully to optimize your ability to survive. The same is true of your mind. So your mind is not a lump of silly putty that is shaped by your experience. It is instead an extremely sophisticated Swiss watch with all kinds of little bells and whistles in it that were designed to help humans optimize their behavior by having automated reactions to things that are important.
Yeah, and you know what really struck me about this making so much sense is, you know, I was watching a talk by a medical doctor named Michael Greger, and he mm-hmm. he runs the website nutritionfacts.org, which is just a phenomenal mm-hmm. amount of information about nutrition, and he had mm-hmm. a talk where he was describing why there's such a failure in medicine to correct the leading causes of death. And he basically said that the problem is that they're not addressing the cause, is they're simply removing the symptoms and then hoping for the best. And I've been kind of interested in this for a long time, and it seems like psychology and psychotherapy today is, in fact, similar to this idea. They're not really getting the cause of the problem, whereas evolutionary psychology seeks to understand the cause of the issue, and that is really just understanding where the organism is coming from, what the mind is actually, what's causing the mind to behave in a certain way.
Yes, I think that's very accurate. I think a good example is, and I don't want to... people might say, well, now, wait a second. How can you say that the learning history of the organism isn't important? It is important, but it's not what people exactly think that it is. And so a great example of for example, a difference between evolutionary psychology and learning theory might be the following. There would be many examples, but one of them that comes to mind is a derivative of learning theory is what's known as cognitive behavioral therapy. So cognitive behavioral therapy is a very well-researched, in fact, it's the best-researched set of techniques for trying to help people. And so, you know, I certainly have a considerable amount of respect for the scientists and clinicians that have gone into its development, as they've worked very diligently and honestly to try to put together a conceptual framework along with techniques to try to help people. Now, it's evident from the standpoint of evolutionary psychology that you can see some glaring problems with cognitive behavioral therapy. So let me give you an example. The cognitive behavioral therapists are aware that when people come in to talk to them, that people have a remarkable amount, if they're depressed, that's the reason they're coming in. And they have a lot of seemingly what the therapist will call self-critical thoughts. So the person will be frustrated and sort of angry with themselves and so on and so forth, and they'll have a lot of negative inferences about themselves. And the cognitive therapist looks at this and says, well, this is what we call your internal critic. They don't have any idea where this comes from, and they don't have any idea why it exists. They just call it the internal critic. And they tell them that what you need to learn to do is to talk back to the internal critic. So they'll do things like if the person says, well, I'll never get a job. And they say, well, you know, that's not quite rational. Really, how do you know that you'll never get a job? And so it seems quite fancy. That we're essentially going to argue with the person and point out where they're being irrational, and so essentially some good could come out of this, but really not quite for the reasons that the cognitive therapist is thinking. So the cognitive therapist is thinking that I am teaching the person to talk back to the internal critic, and that the internal critic is inherently, for some strange reason, human beings have this little critical thing that brings us down and makes us depressed and anxious for no good reason. And it's this pesky little thing that human beings just have to deal with. Well, this is a major conceptual misunderstanding of human nature. There is nothing in cognitive behavioral theory that understands the fundamentals of human motivation. So cognitive therapist sort of knows that people kind of want to feel good. And so sometimes they have these sort of self-downing thoughts from this little pesky chip in there called the internal critic. And, you know, a way to do it is try to talk back to the internal critic like we're arguing with it. Okay. Now, the truth of the matter is that people are motivated to actually compete for deep, complicated, problematic, conflicted domains of competition. Those domains of competition are mates, friends, and trade, and so i.e. a job. So human beings are not a direct return species. They don't typically and never did go out there and do it all for themselves. They traded within their villages about one person doing something well and another person doing something else well, and then they swap. In this way, and we know that this is true, so the anthropologists that think that we were direct return species are incorrect. The truth is that if you observe small children, even by the age of 2, you will see that they spontaneously start to trade. You'll not see anything like this in any other species. Trade is a remarkable characteristic of humans that allows two people to actually swap items that they figure out in their communication. That if I like the blue car and you like the red car, but I happen to have the red car and you happen to have the blue car, if we trade those two things, we are both better off, but nobody did any extra work. this phenomenon has expanded and enabled us to see the society that we do today. But back in the Stone Age, at a very fundamental level, people were already trading, and they needed to figure out what other people thought was valuable and see what they could do to get it in order to trade for other things that they personally wanted. So how much ability you had in trade was a critical feature of your own ability to survive and reproduce. And you might say, well, what do you mean survive and reproduce? Well, if you can get better shiny crap, necklaces and gold beads and stuff like that that the chicks like, then you're much more likely to reproduce than the guy who can't figure out how to get those things. And so you better figure out, you know, what that guy that makes that jewelry likes, and figure out how you're going to get it to him so that you can get some of the shiny jewelry to get yourself laid. So this is, so human beings have been always concerned with how valuable they were to the village, and they can gauge how valuable they are by trade processes. They also can gauge how valuable they are by the esteem signals that are given to them by friends and by potential mates. So cognitive therapy and learning theory are completely, literally bankrupt. They don't have a clue why human beings are doing things. And not only do they not have a clue, they also tend to be upset about the concept of competition and the concept of self-calibrating processes and obvious self-calibrating processes that go on. So, for example, when we fail at a task, it turns out that the reason why we took the task on was in order to compete to try to get the attention of mates, friends, or trading partners. So when we have failed at that competition, we didn't do this. We weren't oblivious when we went into the competition. So I didn't go on a tennis court looking for Pete Sampras and figuring I would beat him. You're self-calibrated, and you go after goals that you have evidence that you believe that you would have, that this would be a useful, a potentially effective use of your time and energy in order to compete in this domain, or else you wouldn't do it. So it turns out that when you fail, you are disappointed. And it's going to turn out also that you are then calibrating, your nervous system calibrates you down and makes you, quote, feel bad about yourself in the aftermath of this kind of a process. Now, the reason why that is true is that the system is designed by nature to try to have you set your goals at an appropriate level that you do not leave chips on the table, that you are as aggressive as is reasonable in terms of trying to reach as high in the food chain as possible with respect to friends, mates, and trading partner, but also to be willing to adjust your self-confidence down when feedback indicates that you have set your sights too high. Now, the cognitive therapist of the world doesn't really understand that there's a self-calibration process, doesn't understand how critical it is for you to actually have failure feedback that causes depression. So depression is seen as, you know, the result of a cognitive distortion that is best removed by arguing with an internal critic, when in fact depression is almost always a transient state that is the result of a disappointing attempt to invest energy and social risk in attempting to compete for either mates, friends, or trading partner, i.e. esteem. And that when we have failed, it is useful to actually not only have the failure experience, but also pay attention to what features were in that experience that we did not anticipate, so that we can actually discover whether or not there's more information on how to compete more effectively. We don't talk back to the internal critic in this way. We listen to the fact that actually the internal critic is not a critic, it's an audience. And what the internal critic is it's actually a resident program inside of humans to enable them to compete more effectively by observing and critiquing their own performances in competition with other people.
Wonderful. Yeah, and you have phenomenal amounts of information, more information about this on your website, esteemdynamics.org. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay,
There's
and
a lot of good
so
stuff there. More to be done.
always more to be done. So last
Yeah.
week we talked about common relationship problems and how to solve them and how to avoid them. And we went over part of an article on WebMD about
Yeah.
seven solutions that can save a relationship. Now,
Right.
just in a couple of minutes, let me recap. We talked about relationship problem number one, communication. And
Right.
what we were basically saying is that communication is absolutely crystal clear. It's that a lot of therapists just don't have the guts to really say what it is that people are communicating, which is if they're having problems communicating, it may not be the communication. It's that that two people may just not be right for each other.
Yes, or they may be going through also just let's point something else out. People can be going through a point in time in their relationship where they are very seriously, somebody is running a cost benefit analysis on this thing, and they are becoming increasingly convinced that they may not want to be there. Now, it may turn out that they change their mind. Okay? So, in the same way that you can change your mind which college you want to go to, after you got four different acceptances and you're going back and forth, and you find out your buddy is going to Illinois State, so maybe that's where you're going to go. So your mind can shift around because there can be, complex algebra that your mind is trying to figure out, what the best move is. But when people are in trouble, they aren't in trouble because of poor communication. When a relationship's in trouble, it is never in trouble behind poor communication. What is being communicated is very clear. Somebody is really considering defection. And it is not, and the person on the other side is not missing the cues. Okay? So I always love this one. Like, oh, my boyfriend just doesn't know how to express love because his mother was, whatever, I don't know, inhibited. It's like, you got to be kidding me. Drives me. When he runs into the chick that he's hot about, he'll be expressing his love just fine. Okay? He's a human being with a 60,000 word vocabulary. All right? He has unbelievable ability to articulate what the heck is going on with him about his likes and dislikes. And so if he is, quote, having a hard time expressing his love, but that you think that that is the issue, yeah, this is delusional. And therapists will line up around the block and maintain that delusion because they do not like to face the fact that human beings are under competitive pressures, and they don't. It offends their soft sensibilities that the world has winners and losers and rejection and competition. And so this is yeah we I think I buried this effectively last week, but yeah that's number one.
Well,
Now I remember.
we even
All
had a
right, go
comment.
ahead.
We even have a comment
Yeah.
for one of the listeners who actually
Yeah.
is at an education university in China. This is
Yeah.
Xiao Li. She said, "It's really inspiring, Dr. Lyle, that the communication itself, the communication problem itself in a relationship is just a lie. It's not really the communication." So we want to
Yes.
really thank Xiao Li for listening. That's yeah.
Beautiful.
So the second relationship problem was sex, and I think we covered that pretty well as well.
Right. Yes. Sex is, remember, you're an animal that represents an unbroken chain of successful sexual reproduction that goes back a billion years. That's 1,000 million years. Okay? If you don't think that this is in high priority to get animals to like it, be super motivated, and to be good at it, you're not thinking clearly. So when people, quote, have sex problems in the relationship, of course it is possible for there to be problems, and there can be possible for people to be fumble fingers and et cetera, et cetera. Of course there's some things to learn. But the truth of the matter is that the vast majority of time when people think that they have sex problems in a relationship, what they really have is they've got somebody in that relationship is ambivalent about being there. And that is another problem that the therapist doesn't want to face.
A friend of mine was telling me, and of course he's in just the dating market, so he's not really in a relationship. And he was saying that he uses the Brad Pitt rule. His potential date doesn't want to sleep with him. He asks himself, would she say no to Brad Pitt? And In this situation.
And
And if
there
she
you
was to
go.
say no, if she says no to Brad Pitt, then he's acceptable. He's accepting of it. But
Yeah.
if she were to say no, that means she's just not that into him.
There you go. Very good.
So,
Yeah.
all right, the
All
next
right.
relationship problem that we talked about was money. And this is
Yes.
where there's communication where the female may want to be provisioning for her child, well, whereas the husband or the male may be thinking that he's got one foot out the door and he may want to save some money for some casual mating strategy later on down the line. But in essence, the money problems, that's another issue.
Yes, and that those are there's some other personality issues, can weave their way in there. And of course, we also talked about how communism is a failure as a concept, and that is because organisms, there's only a few organisms in the world that actually act in a communistic fashion, and those are really like the social insects. I don't know, some biologist out there might be telling me there's a group of bacteria that do this as well. I don't know, but large animals don't do this, and so it's and humans do not. So humans are very cognizant of themselves and where their genetic lines are drawn, and so they're extremely interested in the fact that their children need to make sure that they eat, and if the kid next door needs to starve, too bad. Okay, so we are designed by nature to be extremely self-interested. That doesn't mean exclusively, that just means extremely. And so when we get together with a mate, remember that we do not share any DNA with that mate. We may have an offspring with the mate and have our DNA shared in there, but we do not personally share any DNA with your mate. As a result of that, you are two independent organisms, and to pile all the resources together and then divide them by two. In other words, this is a communistic error, and some people with some personalities can do this well, but it's actually in general a mistake. You want to have the money divided as independently as is practical for your circumstances, and with both people living at the same fundamental standard of living. And so, and then from within that framework, you want people to have their own independent money as much as you can, because people that with their own independent money are considerably more responsible with their money than when they are a member of a team of two. So
All right,
that's
so
that.
are you ready to complete the rest of
Sure.
this list, Dr. Lyle?
Yeah, let's see what else we got.
All right, so moving on to the next, we've got four more. So relationship, I'm going to read the problem and then the problem-solving strategy that this WebMD article suggests.
Right.
So relationship problems, struggle over home chores. Since most partners work outside the home and often at more than one job, it's important to fairly divide the labor at home, says Paulette Sherman, Kaufman Sherman, author of Dating from the Inside Out. So her problem-solving strategies are to be organized and clear about your respective jobs in the home. She said, write down all the jobs and then agree on who does what. And then be fair so that no resentment builds. And be open to other solutions. So if you both hate housework, maybe you can spring for a cleaning service. Or if one of you likes housework, the other person can do the laundry and the yard, and then you can be creative and take preferences into account as long as it feels fair to both of you.
Very good. I mean, this is all fine. I don't have any problem with that. And I quite frankly, I have a little bit of problem with the underlying inference. And that is that if you so don't value your mate and your mate's esteem for you and the cost benefit of the relationship being valuable, to the point where you can't fairly come up with a reasonable strategy for this, then don't blame the fact that we're having trouble with the home chores on why this relationship is going south. This relationship is going south for reasons other than that. Okay? So if two people are so incompetent or self-interested, and so poor at dealing with the opportunity of a lifetime to have this fabulous, exciting person that you're in love with, and that you can't like manage to deal with these issues, then nothing can help you. Now, I will say one other thing that was said here that actually makes a very good sense in principle, and that is that what we don't want to do is you want to actually be trading with your mate as little as possible. You don't want to turn your mate into a trading partner. You want to keep your mate as much as you can to be your mate, okay? And so we want to trade as much as possible with third parties. So the mate doesn't need to be your handyman, doesn't need to be your errand boy, and doesn't need to be your cleaning girl or necessarily even your cook. The truth of the matter is that there are things that are practical for the couple to do, and there are things that may be very practical for other people to do. And as much as is possible, I would trade with outside entities so that we keep the trading process between the two people at a minimum. That is the best solution for romance.
Wonderful.
So incidentally, it's a very generally bad idea for one partner to work for the other partner in a business or for them to be business partners. This is, of course, people will be able to point to 16,472 examples of how this worked beautifully. At least that's what they're told, and that's what it looks like. My dentist, Dr. Johnson, and his wife, Mary, you know what I mean? Good luck to them, okay? But the point is that for every one of those, we had a relationship that morphed its way from a romance and wound up being a business partnership, complete with the begrudging resentments of you know, all of that on there. How many owners of a small business are all happy about their employee or employees? The answer is they're all frustrated with their employees because they feel like the employees should be doing more for less, okay? That is exactly what you do not want two people in a small business looking at each other, thinking about that. In the middle of a romance. So, of course, there may be times when it makes sense, et cetera, but you should keep in mind that in general, that is an extremely bad idea for people in pursuing a romance. They should not, you know, almost never should you be business partners.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. This actually ties into perfectly to the next one, which is relationship problem number five is not making your relationship a priority. If you want to keep your love life going, your relationship a focal point, and that should not end when you say, I do. Relationships lose their luster, so make yours a priority, says Karen Sherman, author of Marriage Magic, Find It, Keep It, and Make It Last. So her problem-solving strategies are do the things you used to do when you were first dating. Show appreciation, compliment each other, contact each other through the day, and show interest in each other. Plan some date nights, schedule time together on the calendar just as you would any other important event in your life. And then respect one another. Say thank you and I appreciate. And it lets you know, lets your partner know that they matter.
Yeah, this is a beautiful example of what we were talking about earlier when we were talking about the cognitive therapists. And this is an example of someone who absolutely is aiming the gun backwards. This person has no idea what they're talking about. So this is an example of course it would be true that if you were to observe two couples in their little houses and one of them is expressing appreciation and they are making time for each other and all that sort of thing, and the other one isn't. And you would say, well, look at how these people do it. That's why their romance is alive. No. Their romance is alive, and that's why you're seeing the things you're seeing. Okay? So it's a complete lack of understanding of what is the motivating force behind the behaviors of interest. Now, so let's talk about probably the single biggest feature in human life that causes the death of romance. The single biggest feature is children, okay? So it's going to turn out that the human female is designed by nature to solve the problems of survival and reproduction just like males are. So they are designed as a reproduction machine. That's what they are. That's what their DNA has built them to do. So it's going to turn out that when they don't have children, they're extremely interested in romance. Of course they are. That they are designed by nature to be very discriminating in trying to choose mates. and they're trying to choose mates that will do what? Put them in an idealized position to have the best possible and most likely of survival and most flourishing child. That's what they're designed to do. So that's the guy they're seeking, okay? Now, once they have that guy and they have sex with him enough and they wind up with a kid, now we want to look inside their heads. What is their priority now? Their priority is they have now done what they were designed by nature to do, and they've reproduced the genetic code. So now it's going to turn out that their priorities have now shifted from the romantic process with the male to the parenting process with the child. This is human nature, okay? So it's useful to know that there's going to be a phenomenal right turn that will take place in this situation. It's useful to know it's there, so it's not about that people aren't expressing their appreciation. It's not about that they haven't made time for each other and that they forgot about it. The problem is that in this case, the nature of life has taken an enormous bite at any possible romantic process that could be continuing to going on with these people, as they are now, she in particular, is fulfilling her biological purpose, and her psychology gets transfixed on the goal of reproduction. And the goal of reproduction is not sex. The goal of reproduction is optimizing that child's competitiveness, okay? So it's useful to know that that is your program. If you're a female, and it's useful to know if you're a male, but that's the program that resides inside the female, okay? Yeah. And as a result, that is something that people need to be highly cognizant of and essentially do the following, that you are designed by nature to give it all to the kid, okay? That this is the end-all, be-all of the evolutionary process, and this is actually a mistake for happiness. This is where you don't beat your genes. Okay, so this is where people need to cognitively recognize or consciously recognize that it is a mistake to give every last bit of energy into child raising. Okay, it should not be about what can we get for Junior, what can we do for Junior, how is Junior doing, we're upset Junior's not doing so well in school. Junior's just fine. Junior actually has a massively better and safer and more promising existence than any human being that ever walked the earth 10,000 or a million years ago. Junior is in unbelievably benign circumstances, and there's no need to be wasting any worrying about Junior in his future. Junior will figure it out just fine. What you will do if you are not careful is your mind can be essentially transfixed on the little tiny, relatively meaningless vicissitudes of Junior's existence, and be worried about buffering Junior against every little tiny little bump and bruise of their life, and instead take that energy away from the mating dynamic. So people should be cognizant of that. That's a big trap for romance, and it's probably the biggest one that there is.
I see this quite a lot, actually, whether mm-hmm. it's with friends, whether it's with family, and whether it's with people like romantic partners, too. It's that's a really good point. Okay, so next relationship problem is conflict.
Yes.
So New York-based psychologist Susan Silverman says that occasional conflict is a part of life, but if you and your partner feel like you're starring in your own nightmare version of Groundhog Day, it's mm-hmm. time to break free of this toxic routine. When you make the effort, you can lessen the anger and take a calm look at underlying issues. So her problem-solving strategies are that you and your partner can learn to argue in a more civil and helpful manner. Make these strategies part of who you are in this relationship. So one, realize you're not a victim. It's your choice whether you react and how you react. Be honest with yourself. Are your comments geared towards resolving the conflict, or are you looking for justice and payback? If you're blaming and hurtful, it's best to take a deep breath and change your strategy. Then change it up. If you continue to respond in a way that's brought you pain and unhappiness, you can't expect a different result this time. Just one little shift can make a big difference.
Yeah, this is all a fiasco. This is someone, again, that doesn't understand that the nature of the conflict, this is as if people don't know how to resolve conflict, and that's what the problem is. People know how to resolve conflicts quite well, okay? But there are conflicts that may not be resolvable in relationships. And so they are recurring. And the recurring dynamic that will drive conflicts in relationships is the difference in people's relative commitment. So this is and this is because essentially one partner very often sees themselves as the person who is being under rewarded, and the other partner feels that feedback. If you feel under rewarded in a relationship, you feel like you've got one foot edging towards the door. You might be locked in by finances and children and in the church, but that doesn't mean that your Stone Age brain isn't saying, you know what, I think I could get a better deal. And so as a result, you may be pulling back out of the relationship, et cetera. And then we can have things that we're going to call conflicts. So we're going to have arguments about things, but that's because people are already feeling shortchanged, for example. And so they're a little quicker if the entire relationship is essentially a very complicated, multidimensional cost-benefit relationship between two individuals, and one individual feels like they are getting the worst end of the deal, then they will take multiple opportunities in different domains in order to try to even the score, okay? In other words, well, if I have to put up with this, then at least I'm not going to do that. And so now the conflicts are arising potentially much more often, and we have a conflicted relationship. It isn't their argument style that's doing this. It's that there's an underlying dynamic of cost-benefit analysis that is problematic to this relationship and is giving turbulence to that relationship stability for usually overwhelmingly good reasons. This doesn't happen out of nowhere. So our little person here, now there are some techniques for people who really love each other but are running into a stage where they are, where for some reason they've got a big hurt on one part and they're having trouble getting past it, and they may go into a short-term exacerbation cycle where there's retaliation and counter-retaliation. That you can step out of, and that is a natural way for people to act that is actually not ideal. And if you go on my website into one of the audios called Flood the Circuit, I go through an explanation of how it is that we can get ourselves out of that kind of argumentative mess. But in general, relationships that are conflicted over time are not conflicted because people don't know how to resolve conflict. They're conflicted because there's an underlying dynamic of cost-benefit analysis that is encouraging one person to send signals that they feel like they're underrewarded in the relationship and they're thinking about leaving.
Mm-hmm. And this is now, you know, flows beautifully into the last relationship problem, which is trust. Mm-hmm. And the author says, trust is a key part of a relationship. Do you see certain things that cause you not to trust your partner, or do you have unresolved issues that prevent you from trusting others? You and your partner can develop trust in each other by following these tips. Be consistent, be on time, do what you say we'll do. There's a whole list of stuff, but to me it reads, be more conscientious, which from our personality talk, you really can't be more conscientious than you already are.
Right. Right. So this is, again, an example of the therapist looking at the frosting and not seeing the cake, that people will be conscientious in a relationship behind two major factors. Number one, how conscientious are they in general genetically? And second of all, how motivated they are. Okay. So if you're a flake and you are highly motivated, you can be incredibly conscientious. And then if you're not very motivated later, then you're going to be a flake. Second of all, if you're very conscientious naturally and you're in a relationship that motivates you, you will, of course, be superbly conscientious. But if you're in a relationship that does not motivate you, you will start to slip in terms of that conscientiousness as your mind is rebelling against the lousy cost-benefit payoff matrix that you have in the relationship, and you'll start to be a flake. And then if we point to that as something that you should do better, we are missing the boat. The truth is that this is you sending a signal that you feel like you're not in the right place and that the deal is not fair for you. So trust is something that to think that people have to be coached and educated into learning to trust is ludicrous. And the notion that they have, quote, unresolved past issues that lead them to be unable to trust is ludicrous. The truth of the matter is that I don't trust a guy with a New Jersey accent and a gun holster in his with really shiny shoes and slick hair and with a tooth missing in front. Like, I can tell, I can't trust this son of a bitch. See what I'm saying? Whereas if Harvey the accountant, who my best friend tells me is a stand-up guy and he's been perfect for him for 30 years, you know what I mean, tells me that that's who I should go have resolve this problem. And I look at him and everything about his office and his personal presentation and his demeanor and his conversation, his words with me, signals tremendous integrity, then I'm going to trust him, okay? So we trust to the level that the evidence tells us. And to say that an individual is so scarred by their history that they're having trouble trusting is nonsense. Of course, some people may be less trusting than others dependent upon their history, but it will never be so far out of bounds that in the right situation, they don't feel that trust starting to develop spontaneously. David Buss, University of Texas, probably the world's leading authority on human mating behavior, ran a study of one of, God knows, probably 150 studies that this guy's run in his career. And it was about relationships that were in trouble and where one party was saying that they thought the other party was cheating on them. Now, this was fascinating. As I remember, the sample size was around 30 or 40 couples, might have been 35 couples. I'm not remembering for sure. I read this study 20 years ago. What they found was fascinating. They found that in almost every single case, when one partner thought that the other partner was cheating, and incidentally, all of these cases within the relationship, the communication in the relationship, the partner who was thought to be cheating denied it. So the one that was saying, I think you're cheating, in every case they were being stonewalled. Okay? Now, it turns out that in every single case, the following turns out to be true. It turns out to be that the other person either was cheating on them or they were very close to cheating. They had somebody lined up. And they were absolutely strongly considering it, and they had one foot out of that relationship and one foot into a new one, okay? There wasn't a single case where the individual who thought they were being cheated on was in fact not being cheated on or damn close, okay? So this was – now, of course, we can throw this out to the universal ether, and we'll come back with 16,471 exceptions where this wasn't true. Okay, and I'll have a bunch of people saying, well, it was true. I had a girlfriend who thought I was cheating, and I was, you know what I'm saying, et cetera. Of course there are exceptions. Of course we are sometimes in a relationship with a borderline personality disorder that thinks we're cheating on them all the time, and we're not, okay? But these are absolutely exceptions to the rule. The truth of the matter is that people, if anything, people overtrust. Okay, if anything is the case, that is the case. So trust issues are not major obstacles to romance. And if it looks like you are having a trust issue that's an obstacle to your romance, the odds are overwhelming that has nothing to do with it. The odds are that there are good reasons for the anxiety that we're seeing.
Well, I think this sheds a really good light onto this on this topic. And with that in mind, I have an example for you. It's a relationship issue, kind of a conflict that came up, and I'm going to read it on air, and then let's just get your take on it, kind of see the practical application of this, of what we've been talking about. So this is a male who's writing this. He's a 35-year-old male, and his wife is 32 years old. They've been married for 12 years, two kids, age 10 and 8. He says, my wife has become a vegetarian. It started gradually and she became full-time as of 6 months ago. She did it for health reasons, but also for some moral reasons because she believes eating animals is wrong and it's also healthier. Fine, I don't have a problem with that. And early on, she tried to get me to become a vegetarian and eat less meat. I tried it. I tried her dishes, usually various recipes, but I hated them and I didn't like the taste of it at all. So normally what I do is we each cook our separate meals. She cook hers. Mm-hmm. I cook mine. I always cook meat with mine because I love it, and I cook fish.
Mm-hmm.
With regards to the children, I always say to let them choose what they want to eat. They can eat from my plate or they can eat from hers. They more or less usually choose mine, but they eat from both, although mostly from mine. And she always complains that I eat too much meat. I told her, too bad. I like meat. I don't police what she eats, and she doesn't have the right to police what I eat. She's tried to bring it up many times, but I always shut her down because I told her I find it really annoying when she keeps telling me to stop eating what I like to eat. It's my life, my body. I choose what I put in my mouth. The other thing is about our children. She says they should eat the vegetarian stuff more and wants to gradually make them vegetarian like her. And I said, they're both our children. Neither of us should make unilateral decisions on what they can or can't eat. She can't forbid them from eating something without my approval, and I won't forbid them from eating something without her approval. Nobody stops them from eating vegetarian. It's there wherever, whenever they want it. They simply choose more often than not to eat what I'm cooking. She doesn't like that, and I say, what should I do? I'm not going to tell them, no, you can't eat this. It's only for Dad, and eat the food while they look hungrily on. And I've already said that I'm not going to switch vegetarian. It's not happening, and she needs to get that through her head. She always complains about the smell or the way my food looks, tells me that it's really revolting and it's grossing her out. Oh, well, I find her food revolting. Basically, she's become very annoying about the subject because as far as I'm concerned, it's settled. I'm not giving up my eating habits. I'm not shoving pieces of meat in her mouth, so she shouldn't be trying to shove her food into my mouth. How can I get her to just drop the issue?
This is actually a heck of a case. Very interesting case. So the a few things that that I would pick up the about this. Now, the what we want to look for here is look for what we're going to call the esteem dynamic. So whenever we don't understand something about human nature, always look for the esteem dynamic in the situation. So here we have the wife signaling to the man that he is basically uneducated, sloth, stupid, and he's disgusting, and he's poisoning her children, et cetera, and poisoning himself. So he's by her estimation, he is indicating low conscientiousness and low intelligence, and she's actually disgusted by this, and she's signaling that disgust. The and she furthermore has little moral chips running around in her head, not only about the animals but particularly about her children. The guy, on the other hand, these two people fundamentally disagree about the facts. So he essentially he sounds like he's perfectly thoughtful. So he is not eating the way he's eating because he's some sort of a glutton that doesn't care about his health. That is not being signaled here. They appear to have a disagreement about the importance of this issue, and so he is pushing back pretty hard against the inference that she is signaling. Now, I would also say, and I could be mistaken, but I would say it's interesting that he is having this reaction, because my guess is if he were highly sexually attracted to her, then he might be a hell of a lot more amenable to changing his diet, or be far more sympathetic with her position. Or it also could be the case that if she is if she has been sexually rejecting of him in the relationship at this point, if that is the case, then he might be irritated enough at this that he is essentially retaliating and rejecting her, the new information that she's bringing to the village, and basically saying, the hell with you and your information. You know, I don't see any moral high ground why I have to accept this. And in fact, if it makes you miserable that I'm going to go on strike against your crusade,
then so much the better, because the relationship isn't that worth it to me anyway. So this is a lot of anger, and I'm not sure what the esteem dynamic is between the two of them in terms of their sexual chemistry and who is feeling what with respect to the relationship as far as this goes. But I will say this, I believe that the analysis of that sexual chemistry and what people are thinking and feeling and et cetera with respect to that is absolutely key to understanding the argument that we have. Now, there is one chance, and it's a legitimate one, that what we actually have is a pretty serious fundamental misunderstanding of reality on the part of our female, okay? And so it could be that I'm missing the boat, that these people were fine in terms of their sexual chemistry. They had a standard process where he found her beautiful and sexy, and she found him admirable as a human, and their chemistry was fine, and they're having sex 2-3 times a week or whatever, 10 times a month, which is the worldwide average for couples that are actually happy with each other. And so, something close to that. And so the point is that we didn't have a problem, and now we have a problem, okay? And now this problem could be traced directly to this conflict. If this is true, then we actually probably have a woman who doesn't understand the facts about health and diet. The truth of the matter is that a vegetarian diet is very, a healthy vegetarian diet can be a very, very healthy diet, but so can a diet that includes animal food. And so, but she may not know that, because she may have been subjected to and been learning from people that are very trustworthy and wise and smart and are trying to spread important health information to the world, but she can actually miscalibrate this information very easily. So, for example, it's very easy for people to read this information, for example, about advanced heart disease and how useful it can be to go on a vegan diet, and it can reverse it, and no other diet can do this. And they can be thinking that this is very critically important for their children, when this is absurd, okay? People will develop these pathologies over decades of pretty substandard dietary behavior, of which animal food in large quantities is only one of the problems. And so she can actually be having a lot of anxiety about her children's diet when she's actually misunderstanding what the facts are. The facts are that a very healthy diet against a very unhealthy diet in the society is responsible for less than 5% difference in lifespan. But if you were to talk to a vegetarian mom who has read a bunch of stuff and considers herself knowledgeable, she would be absolutely flabbergasted to find out that that is the truth. And she is thinking that she is seeding the flower bed of cancer and heart disease with every bite of fish that her child may eat, and that is not true. The human being is a natural omnivore. We can get this way out of balance in the modern environment, and we do. I certainly lean to and support healthy plant-based diets. That doesn't mean that diets that include animal foods cannot be very healthy diets. They absolutely can be. And it could be that the source of this marital conflict could be literally on the stake that we see in the ground that everybody's twisted up about. And it could be that she needs a consultation with somebody like myself who can actually set the record straight. So, and that can take down her anxiety and then a lot of her frustration with her partner, and that we can reestablish. Right now, she may be feeling like he is irresponsible with respect to her children, and that makes her feel very anxious and upset with him. So I'm not sure what all the details are, but those are some hypotheses in this landscape.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.